Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to this Council on Foreign Relations conference call. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you very much for joining us. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website at cfr.org. We're delighted to have Ned Parker with us today to discuss the current situation in Iraq and the challenges of overcoming sectarian divisions. Mr. Parker is currently the Reuters Bureau Chief in Baghdad and served as the Los Angeles Times Bureau Chief in Baghdad from 2009 to 2011. He also was the Edward R. Murrow Press Fellow here at the Council on Foreign Relations and spent a year here. We really enjoyed having him in the building. And he has written extensively on Islamic militancy, regional politics, and Iraq's sectarian war. And I encourage you all to follow him on Twitter at NedMParker1. So welcome, Ned. Thank you for joining us all the way from Baghdad. I think today's call is very timely given Secretary of State John Kerry's surprise visit to Baghdad today, and I think President Obama will be addressing the situation tonight. So it would be great if you could talk briefly about what you're seeing happening on the ground and anything else you would like to give us in the way of analysis.
Sure. Right. I'll talk for about 10 minutes, and then we'll take questions. Thanks so much for having me, Irina, and it's great to be back with the Council again today. Iraq is at a very key, fascinating moment right now that really the future of what Iraq will be hinges on I think, what happens in the coming months. As we all saw, I think the world was shocked the second week of June when the Islamic State took Iraq's largest city in the north, Mosul, and then charged down through the Tigris River Valley, taking towns and villages across multiple provinces. By the time the dust cleared, Iraq had lost about a third of its territory to armed Sunni groups led by the Islamic State, a military that the United States had trained for the course of a decade at the cost of about $25 billion had melted away in the north like that overnight. It was stunning. It was a volcanic. So the challenge now in Iraq is there's a new government in place, a moderate Shiite Islamist prime minister in Haider Abadi. A new government, like the last government, it was also inclusive, as the new government is called inclusive. The problem was the process had broken down under Abadi's predecessor, Prime Minister Nouri Maliki, who was also from the same political party as Abadi, the Islamic Dawah Party. So now there's someone who's thought to be more pragmatic, moderate, less confrontational in charge, who is trying to repair the breach with the Sunni minority community that really dominated power throughout the course of Iraq's modern history until the U.S. invasion in 2003, and the Kurdish minority in the north, which since 1990 has created a semi-autonomous zone, which is now flirting with the idea of independence and has become disenchanted with the politics of Iraq's Shiite majority in Baghdad. Can Abadi bring the country back together? Can he most crucially win the Sunnis back, who are basically out of control now of Baghdad, outside the control of the central government? In many ways, it's a tough situation because the facts on the ground have outpaced the political events. So what we see in Baghdad, even today, when Secretary of State Kerry visited and toured the Green Zone and met with Abadi and met with others, and made pronouncements of how this is a new start and Iraq is now a key partner, a strategic partner, an engine in the fight against the Islamic State. It's not clear whether or not the government in Iraq is capable of shaping the facts on the ground because things have advanced so far. So we're looking at this question of how can Baghdad win back the Sunnis? They seem to have a truce. The body has a truce with the Kurds in the north, at least for 3 months, about the division of revenues. And then settling broader questions of, can the Kurds negotiate their own contracts with oil companies, which they have been doing now since a good seven years or so, and also broader questions of disputed territories that Baghdad and the Kurds claim, those questions will be settled over the coming year in theory. But the key question, the burning question, is the Sunnis, and that is very, very, very tough. While the Islamic State is a ruthless force with weapons, modern weapons, military weapons, harvested from Syria, harvested from Iraq since June, are now in control of 5 oil fields in Iraq, oil fields in Syria, even crops in Iraq's north, with the ability to generate money and this prowess on the internet in terms of videos and Twitter, ability to recruit fighters from abroad. Despite all of that, the Islamic State is just a portion of the Sunni community in Iraq. The disenfranchisement, the anger of Sunni Iraqis is what powers the Islamic State. There are multiple groups that are backing the Islamic State, whether tribal, old military connection, old military officers, armed groups that fought the Americans and then went dormant and are now resurgent. Those are the groups that in theory could be picked off from the Islamic State. But to do that, Iraq has to offer things and offer things quickly in terms of reforms that the Sunnis would want. What we saw in June in many ways was the collapse of the end of the U.S. Process that started in 2003. The Sunnis who first revolted against the Americans early on, then fought kind of the new Shiite-led order in 2007, decided, the Sunni community really decided in full to become part of the process and had the hope that there would be a way to be integrated that did not materialize, and the, you know, politics of Prime Minister Maliki alienated them more, so they all decided to rise up. So at this point, when they look at the situation, they feel that the government in Baghdad has to offer them an end to arrest under the broad title of a terrorism. It's called Article 4 terrorism. It's a counterterrorism law that was passed in 2005 that allows people to be just arrested on a blanket charge of terrorism. So you have many Sunnis, thousands of Sunnis who have been in jail for years on this broad charge without going before a court. Oftentimes, security forces, when they would arrest people under these charges, would then torture them and insist that if they were given $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, the person could be released. So it's this kind of core issue that the Sunnis want addressed. So can that be done? Can it be done quickly? Another thing is the purging of people who belong to Saddam Hussein's party, the Ba'ath Party, before 2003. They were basically disenfranchised after that, no longer allowed to participate in the public sector or military. Efforts to reform that over the years have been abysmal. That's something that has to be addressed quickly. The Sunnis look and don't really trust Baghdad anymore. They don't think that the Shia will deliver. And then the other sort of catch-22, if you will, is that once the Islamic State rose up and had its summer offensive beginning in June, and the Iraqi army really imploded in the north. We're talking about 5 army divisions. The call by a Shiite cleric, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, for ordinary Shia to stand up and join with the security forces to fight was taken as a call by Shiite militia groups that had really been rebuilding themselves in recent years to become active and to work as paramilitary forces. In Sunni areas, both defend Baghdad and Shiite areas legitimately against the real existential threat brought by this group, the Islamic State, that use Shiites as heretics and commits horrible, you know, horrible, barbaric acts. There was this real need to stop the Islamic State. But in doing that and having these kind of Shiite paramilitaries picking up the slack of the Iraqi army, there have definitely been extrajudicial killings. And because of the history of Iraq's civil war in the last decade, when these militias were previously active the same way Al-Qaeda was in armed Sunni groups. The Sunnis now, when they look, they say, how can I trust Baghdad and decide to fight the Islamic State when I can't really trust them to give their word on implementing reforms? We've heard this before and they never did it. And now these militia groups are active again that killed my family. So if that's the case, then I'm better to stick with the Islamic State. So that's really the challenge right now, is how do you bring the Sunnis on board when basically they've lost faith? And Baghdad is really playing catch-up, because it's not clear that even Haider Abadi, the new prime minister, has the power or force to rein in these militia groups, in part because his own community, the Shiite majority, feels that they need to be protected, because you'll have Shiite political rivals who will view his efforts at reconciliation or even reining in these groups as an opening for them to attack Abadi because they would like to be prime minister. And then the sad fact is the Sunni community itself is so fragmented and fractured, with intense competition within, both with the Sunni political elite, who have no real power on the ground, who are in the government, but really are not represented in what's happening in all these provinces where the Islamic State is, and other Sunni armed groups. They're competing amongst themselves, the different Sunni parties. And when you look at these different fighters who are in the different provinces under the Islamic State's control, even if they're thinking, yes, I want to cut a deal, I want to find a way to work with Baghdad, or even I want to find a way to work with the Americans, they're each competing against one another. So the Sunnis themselves are so fragmented, that works in the Islamic State's favor. So the situation on the ground in Iraq is very dynamic, it's very fluid, and it's very dire. And Baghdad, with a political elite that has not changed over the past decade, and are basically in this new government in a new game of musical chairs, where these same players, for the most part, have not shown the ability to work together, to compromise, to make the necessary political sacrifices to make the Iraqi state a success. They now have to show that they're capable of doing bold moves and working together as a team to really promote reconciliation, to bring everyone on side. So that's what's at stake. And Irina, I leave it to you now in terms of questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Ned. Let's open up to the group for questions.
At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. And once again, to ask a question, that's star 1. Our first question comes from Saj Ubad with Muslim Peace Coalition.
Hello, thanks for such a wonderful and informative background. Iraq and Syria are now linked because of Iran's support to Assad and ISIS controlling areas in both. So without countering the genocide going on by Assad, who has killed a lot more people than ISIS had, how can this terrorist threat by ISIS be countered completely? And isn't Iran, will not Iran be the biggest winner in this all? You know, nobody's talking about Iran's threat and Iran's long-term ambitions in the region, and everybody is running to counter ISIS.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for the questions. They're great questions. Basically, you're asking how can the Islamic State be defeated or be contained? And I think you're right. Iraq and Syria are linked. The Islamic State now is able to move across the Iraqi and Syrian border with ease. Transporting weapons, fighters, financial assets. Bombers in Baghdad come from Syria sometimes. Weapons from Mosul have gone to Syria. And it goes on and on. And the Islamic State started in Iraq and was basically weakened by 2009 and then was holding on, incubating, if you will, in different rural areas in Iraq and seized upon the realities in Syria after the Syrian uprising began. So when we look at Iraq and the issue of defeating or containing the Islamic State, I mean, I think we should look at numbers. It's helpful. The Islamic State in Iraq before June was probably, and you know, this isn't a science, but rough estimates are we're talking 3,000 to 5,000 people in Iraq and in Syria. I'm assuming it was a comparable number. So we're not talking huge numbers of people. We're not really talking large military divisions. We're talking about a group of fanatical true believers who've been able to prey upon the rifts within two countries. And they've been able to offer an ideology to people who are desperate about the idea of a caliphate that appeals because their lives are so wretched or they're simply true believers. So in Iraq and in Syria in different ways, I think finding viable, workable political solutions that offer people some dignity is the best solution. And then I suppose that's coupled with when you look at, for instance, the surge in Iraq in 2007, 2008, decisive military action when needed. I'm a journalist, so I'm not an expert on that kind of thing, nor should I be saying when military action is necessary. But Iraq's problems are based upon the failure to have a workable government with a judiciary that's independent, that gets cases through the courts in a timely fashion, that's transparent, where people do not feel the judiciary is politicized or tainted by corruption, or where confessions by detainees are coerced under torture. If you start to wipe out that type of thing, if you're able to start to have a viable buoyant economy in a country with such huge oil reserves, then the Islamic State naturally becomes weaker because there's a limit to what that type of ideology can offer. Similarly, a political solution needs to be found in Syria. And that would be my answer. As for Iran being the big winner, I think Iran has its own internal disputes. It's far from a stable country. There's a robust debate inside Iran about what type of nation it wants to be. And the battles over Iraq or the battles over Syria in the end deplete its own resources and its own costs. In the end, potentially endangers Iran's national security, particularly when you look at what's happening in Iraq now. You can say that the advocacy by, Iran's Revolutionary Guard of hardline militias and sectarian politics in the last 4 years helped contribute to the moment when the Islamic State found an opening and could exploit that to seize territory. And now the Islamic State is on Iran's border, so clearly Iran, no one is truly winning from the realities of today in Iraq and Syria.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Cedric Sussman with World Affairs Council of Atlanta.
Thank you very much. I would like to continue on that vein, Ned, and you've talked about Iran, which was at the top of my question, but what about Saudi Arabia's view and the possible coalition that President Obama is trying to put together that I think includes Turkey? How do these other countries see the situation, and how do you think they can contribute?
Well, I would say, the caveat, definitely my primary area of expertise is Iraq, but I obviously for the Saudis, the threat of the Islamic State is huge to them. The Saudi royal family, the heads of the royal family are aging. There are huge problems with unemployment in Saudi Arabia. There's a possibility of in the coming years of we could see the types of protests that we saw in other parts of the Arab world in 2011 that were called an Arab Spring, a radical Salafist ideology like the Islamic State has appeal and sympathy there. There have been attacks. There were attacks by Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia in the earlier part of the last decade. So clearly they want to check the power of the Islamic State, particularly if someone like Abu Bakr Baghdadi presents himself as the legitimate bearer of or keeper of Islam today. That's a threat to the whole definition of the Saudis and the way they justify their rule as being the keepers, protectors of Mecca. Jordan as well is a fragile state. It's overrun by a million refugees from the Syria conflict. The Islamic State, Abu Musab Zarqawi, was from Jordan. There's a history of Islamic radicalism there. Clearly they have an interest in a stable Middle East, so they want that too. Turkey has been affected clearly by its border with Syria and the traffic of fighters into Syria via Turkey. So they have a clear interest in wanting to contain the threat. So there's common ground. But I would say is I think the danger in all of this in this war against the Islamic State, while the Islamic State military prowess and financial revenues cannot be underestimated, I think the danger, particularly in places like Iraq, is that if the emphasis in the end is upon fighting this war first without finding ways to truly promote good governance and strong institutions, a war on the Islamic State will only lead to greater radicalism. And I think that we could just look to the beginning of this year in Iraq when the Islamic State, still then called the Islamic State of Syria and the Levant, when it first waved its black flags in January in Fallujah and Ramadi, the world became hysterical about Al-Qaeda. The Islamic State is back. It's back in Iraq. It's taken over this province that, you know, the Marines fought to cleanse this horrible scourge. The United States in the first part of the year really backed the government, providing them with Hellfire missiles and other ammunition to attack the Islamic State there. But the reality was, even though the Islamic State, while it was strong, it wasn't the only force on the ground in these places. There was a clear tribal revolt going on. You had some Sunnis angling to be aligned with Prime Minister Maliki in basically not just fighting the Islamic State, but fighting rival tribes because they wanted to be the most powerful force in the province. And they got millions of dollars in the process of doing this. So in the first 6 months of the year in Iraq and Anbar, you had a quote-unquote war on terror there against the Islamic State. The Islamic State wasn't defeated. You had over 430,000 people displaced. And through the course of it, people became more radicalized. And in my own experiences in talking with tribal figures and residents of Anbar, by June, it was no longer worth fighting. Prime Minister, you were fighting the government in Baghdad because they attacked our cities, which they did. This is how that fight started, and the Islamic State muscled in and took advantage of Baghdad attacking the cities and then tribal fighters coming up in revolt. The Islamic State saw an opportunity in that, but what you had then by June really was people who first were just angry at Baghdad and had real grievances and hated the Islamic State and hated it, its predecessor, Al-Qaeda. Suddenly, they no longer saw themselves as, fighting for their rights and hating Al-Qaeda. They suddenly thought, well, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and there's no difference between myself fighting with my gun against Baghdad and the Islamic State because they're going to kill all of us. And that's the problem now, if there isn't a real concrete program, not just for an inclusive government, but for creating job opportunities and creating institutions that work, than simply a matter of sending Iraqi forces into areas to do raids, bombardments, airstrikes. That's only going to create a nastier breed of the Islamic State. The Islamic State is just the latest incarnation of what Abu Musab Zarqawi was doing in 2006 and 2007. We need a political process that gives people hope, and I think that's the case across the region.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Tony Kyropoulos with the National Council of Churches of Christ.
Thank you. Thank you, Ned, for your comments. You may have just hinted at an answer or begin to answer this question, but what I'm struck by is how quickly ISIS has grown to be such a threat. Seems like in the last, just in the last 6 months, it's grown to be such a threat to the point where we're talking about threats to U.S. national security and all. How did this happen? And also, was it just a massive intelligence failure that we didn't see it coming and couldn't have stopped it at different points along the road?
Sure. Well, I think, again, I think we have to, when we look at ISIS, it is a very, the Islamic State, it is a clear threat. It's frightening. They've done barbaric things. We've seen videos of people beheaded and et cetera. But I think in the end, we have to keep it, the governments are right to want to contain it, to want to weaken it. But as much of a threat as it is, it's still, when we talk about the number of people who are the Islamic State, it's pretty small at the end of the day. We're talking probably, we're not talking 100,000 people. We're talking well below maybe 20, depending how you want to quantify them, with true believers and someone who's a fighter one day and the other not, or even, you know, the jihadi, would-be jihadis coming from Europe and the United States. I mean, we're not talking hundreds of thousands of people. So a guy going into a movie theater in Denver and shooting it up, and that's really the threat you're looking at from the Islamic State, and that's not to minimize it. It has to be tackled. But I think there's a tendency to get hysterical, and I think we just have to look at this, you know, someone living in the United States, you have to look at it coolly and, dispassionately. Our officials, our governments need to look at it in a very cool way. I think when there's talk about, you know, in bombastic terms about chasing the Islamic State all the way to hell, that actually plays into the hands of the Islamic State. The more bombastic the statement by our elected officials, that empowers and serves as propaganda for the Islamic State and makes it bigger. Going forward, and even when we talk about what the Islamic State is on the ground, I think we have to kind of strip away the myth of the Islamic State. They're shock and awe of beheadings and gore on the ground. The territory they hold, they don't hold in full. They hold areas. In Syria, they hold Raqqa, and they hold areas around Aleppo. But there are a whole coalition of different armed groups, of Sunni groups, that one day are friends and the next day are fighting each other. And in Iraq, it has to be looked at in a similar way. So we're really not seeing, they have maybe city-states, but they don't control territory the way a country does. And that's not to minimize the resources they have or the weapons they have, the way they're able to draw people now, but the more hysterically they're talking public officials, that's only empowering them and giving them more publicity. Was there a massive intelligence failure? I think it's fair to say that the United States minimized the threat. It didn't pay close enough attention to what was happening in Iraq. Iraq is different from Syria in that in Syria, the United States doesn't have the ability to influence events in the same way. In Iraq, the United States has been in the process here in 2003. So they're very much involved. Not getting into the debate about whether U.S. troops should have stayed or not stayed, it was clear by the beginning of 2013, certainly by the spring, that the Islamic State was making the most of the ability to go across borders. And in part, the Iraqi government under Maliki underestimated the threat as well and did not want that much U.S. involvement. But once U.S. troops left in the end of 2011, really, both countries kind of failed to communicate well in terms of strategic issues, in terms of sharing intelligence.
and that really was not repaired or was not begun. The two sides didn't really start to repair it until Maliki made his visit to the United States in November 2013. So was it a massive intelligence failure? Was it was the White House not keeping its eye on the ball the way it should have? You can argue that, but the situation was complicated on the ground.
Thank you. Next question. Our next question comes from Sister Simone Campbell with Network.
Thank you so much for this clear briefing. I really appreciate it. My concern is about the number of internally displaced people within Iraq. You mentioned the pressure on Jordan hosting so many refugees from both Syria and also still from Iraq. And also the challenge with assimilating the Sunnis into the government. But I, as a person of faith, I'm also extremely concerned about what is happening to the religious minorities within this struggle and the impact on Christians, Yazidis, and other minorities. Do you have a sense of how that's playing out, and is there any capacity on the part of the government to address this destabilizing influence?
Right. No, you're spot on with your concern about refugees, and there are so many. I mean, that's one of the true tragedies of the last year in Iraq. I mean, starting with Anbar again. I mean, there were in the first part of the year 430,000 people displaced in the name of fighting the Islamic State. And in the end, that empowered the Islamic State and left huge numbers of people in refugee camps in Kurdistan, in Baghdad, squatting in homes. And that, in turn, kind of allows an opportunity for greater radicalism. And then with what we've had up north, it's also tragic, and that's from the side of the Islamic State in what it's done. And, I mean, there has been an effort to house people in Kurdistan, and I think that there are still areas that are very vulnerable. The northern, really northern Iraq has been changed, and the whole country has been changed in horrible ways. Central Authority has basically been gutted, eviscerated from, what does Baghdad really control right now? It doesn't control the Sunni areas, arguably in the south now, because Shiite militias have been empowered. It's really hard to say what's the most powerful force on the street amongst the Shia. And then when we look at the north itself, areas where Yazidis lived, Christians lived, those areas have now been purged by the Islamic State. So this year in Iraq, we're seeing populations forcibly displaced, people being uprooted in ways we couldn't have imagined. Something similar happened in 2006, particularly to both Sunnis and Shia after the Samarra shrine bombing. And that too, the damage of those displacements, it hasn't been fixed. Once people are uprooted, it's very hard to bring them back. And the government, as you asked, until now, really, Iraq's administrative ability and capacity to orchestrate and to take care of civilians is woefully inadequate. They just don't have the people. The ministries have been so ruined by patronage for parties, by family, by corruption, that it's very hard to really take care of it's hard for Iraq to take care of its own citizens. So the displaced populations now, it's going to be a huge strain and responsibility for the Iraqi government. It's not clear that they can take care of them.
Thank you. Next question. Our next question comes from Ricardo Tavares with Tech Policy.
Ned, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with us. I'm curious about what's happening with two characters of Iraqi politics. First, Nouri al-Malik. Is he happily in retirement, or he is still one of the contenders for power among the Shia. And the second character is Tariq al-Hashimi, the vice president that was convicted to death by the judiciary under Malik. Is he still in the Kurdistan area, or he was back in Baghdad?
Okay, sure. Well, I mean, Tariq al-Hashimi, he's back and forth, really, between Turkey and places in the Gulf. So he has not come back. Because he's been convicted, sentenced to death, it's not clear that he will. I would say that in Iraqi politics at the top, it's hard not to have anyone in charge who's not is not guilty by association somehow to violence that has happened on the streets in Iraq over the last decade. It's just unheard of. The problem in the Tariq Hashimi case, again, is that the judiciary system is so flawed. Even if he himself was involved in carrying out assassinations, there are serious questions about whether some of his bodyguards who confessed against him were tortured. The testimony itself is tainted. So it'll be interesting in the coming year or two if there is a way that he comes back. As for Nouri al-Maliki, ironically, he's now been named a vice president as Tariq al-Hashimi was a vice president, so is now Nouri al-Maliki. Will he be happy with that? That's the big question. Nouri al-Maliki really, he started in 2006 in a position similar to where Haider al-Abadi is today, in that Nouri al-Maliki was a compromised candidate. He was seen as weak and as not a threat to any of the other political parties. And he was incredibly weak his first few years in power, but then he was able to slowly build up a power base and ultimately control the security forces through his office and have appointees throughout ministries across the Iraqi government and have a huge fund of money within his prime minister's office. He was really the most powerful person in Iraq. So the question is, now that he's out of office, has that power really disappeared? Will he be able to maintain those patronage networks? And will he be happy playing second fiddle to Haider al-Abadi? Or will he try to sabotage him and ultimately come back to power or have someone who he considers more of a protege replace him? And the jury is really out on that. One telling detail is during the parliament session on Monday, when Haider al-Abadi's government was approved, policies of the government was read out by al-Abadi, and in it he talked about how mistakes were made in the last 4 years. And it was said diplomatically, but it was probably felt to Nouri al-Maliki's eyes as an affront, and he did not clap at the end when everyone else did for the program of the next government. So we'll really have to watch and see what Maliki does.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Robert Lipton with RM Power Systems.
Hi. Excuse me. At the beginning of the discourse, you outlined the daunting challenges facing the government of Iraq today. If they fail to meet those challenges, what would be the worst-case scenario that you see happening? And to what extent, other than humanitarian implications, do you see the interests of the United States seriously compromised by that?
Well, if things stay the way they are today, we'll probably see some form of an independent Kurdistan, an independent Kurdistan declared. Or even if it's not declared, it'll just exist de facto in a way that it does now, but they'll be pumping oil from disputed territories that are now under their control in Upper Nineveh province, and they'll be self-sufficient. Now, there's nothing horrible in that, and they'll probably have some arrangement with the international community to defend its borders, protect its borders, so we don't see a scenario as we did in August where the Islamic State almost ran all the way up to the capital of Kurdistan. So let's move down then to the Sunni region. I think basically we'll see you know, a third of the country that's basically the equivalent of Somalia at its worst, lawless with different armed tribal factions, radical Islamist factions that are fighting each other for power, at war with themselves and at war perhaps with the rest of the world, but who knows, but it'll be very much sort of a no-go zone, a badlands, and it'll be a miserable place for people to live. And it'll probably foster radicalism, but I think it'll be an immediate threat for Iraq. It's conjecture what it means for the rest of the world. And then we look at Baghdad, which is Shia, and then the Shia South. And I think if Iraq continues to be this way with a kind of lawless Sunni badlands with a group like the Islamic State and large numbers of displaced people, and it's hard to see how Shiite Iraq from Baghdad down, which still does have a Sunni population, how, one, it'll be immune from attacks by Sunni groups because they'll still identify Baghdad as their capital, but it'll kind of prevent the possibility of good governance emerging for the Shia themselves, and we'll basically continue to see sort of a kleptocratic oil state with different Shiite parties, benefiting from the oil wealth while large portions of the population live in poverty, and parties have Shiite paramilitary groups that rule on the street. Now, that's not good for the state. It basically means the breakup of Iraq, and I don't think it's good for the Middle East as a region. So when we look now and we see how America keeps getting involved militarily in the affairs of the Middle East, surely if Iraq does break up de facto into three regions, or four or five, and you have a similar scenario in Syria, it's hard to know how that plays out for neighboring countries, for Saudi Arabia, for Jordan, even for Israel. So there's a clear need or investment to try to help Iraq itself, and part of that is containing the Islamic State, but I would argue more crucially is the matter of helping Iraq build up the institutions so people feel that they have a stake in Baghdad. That said, because of what happened in June, it might be too late. And when you look at the players in Baghdad, in the political class, they're the usual suspects. And someone like Haider al-Abadi, he is a moderate man, he's a learned man, he's a pragmatic man, and there are definitely others like him within the national government. But for the last decade, the people in charge have not shown the ability to come together and really build something better. America hasn't been perfect in this, and there are strong arguments to be made that politically America, not just talking about whether troops should have stayed or not, which I think is a false argument, but there's a strong argument to be made that in terms of the use of soft power to help Iraq build strong functioning institutions, the Obama administration really dropped the ball after 2010. Certainly the Bush administration did a horrible job too, but it's a sad fact because in 2010 things were starting to look better and decisions were made in the context of how to draw down as opposed to help Iraq build up. But that's where we are today, or that's where the world is today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Carlisle Murphy, with freelance journalist.
Good morning. Thank you, Ned, for your reporting. I know how hard it is to work in Baghdad. Actually, my question is a follow-up on what you've been saying about the U.S. I'm interested in knowing what you think is the best way for the U.S. concretely to exert its soft power, and if you think it will ultimately be successful in creating valid institutions people can have trust in.
Great question. I mean, I guess like the cynical side would be, well, America had, 140,000, 160,000 troops, et cetera, in Iraq till sometime in 2010, and and, you know, another, whatever, 50,000 troops through into 2011 and a huge embassy. And with all that influence, they weren't able to, the U.S. wasn't able to help Iraq get that much done. So what hope is there? That said, I mean, the Iraqis, in the end, have to do it themselves. America has to be engaged. It has to. It's great that, you know, Secretary of State Kerry came to Iraq today. You know, unfortunately, from really the beginning of 2011 until this year, there was there were certainly visits by, you know, whatever, undersecretaries and deputies of the National Security Council, but not someone on the caliber of Kerry coming, engaging in the political process. But that support needs to be supportive of Iraqis, not dictating and or picking and choosing winners. So I don't really have, I wouldn't say I, you know, have the answer to that question, but I think one could say that since June that, you know, President Obama's policy, it did, they saw, you know, Maliki as problematic, and they didn't pick the winner. They made clear they were unhappy with Maliki, but the Iraqis were unhappy with Maliki, and the reasons were clear, because of the utter disaster of Mosul and a third of the country falling under the control of the Islamic State and other groups, and the army collapsing. But America made clear what it thought, that Maliki should go, and that Haider Abadi was picked. It was clear that that was someone America was okay with, but they didn't choose him. And he's someone who is pragmatic. So I think they should try to, I mean, ideally they need to try to be a good partner. Iraq has a lot of oil money. But I guess the point is they need to be emphasizing these core values of reforming your judiciary, reforming de-Baathification, helping the Iraqis find practical solutions so that security forces don't torture detainees in interrogation rooms. I know, for instance, the UN has little practical solutions that some other people on the ground think could help solve, you know, those kind of nuts and bolts problems of to get around, you know, torture and detention centers, et cetera. So it's not a great answer to your question, but I guess it's just a matter of focusing on soft power, helping the Iraqis find the solutions themselves. When America tries to pick winners, that's when they get problems in Iraq. So.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from David Mize.
Thank you, Ned. In light of the collapse of the Iraqi military in the north, what's the current capability of the Iraqi military, and what's its future potential? And if they did try to get to a more balanced state, with the Iraqi army, would you see them ever being able to effectively take on some of the Shiite militias that have reformed?
Great questions. I think we can say that the military force as it is today, I mean, the divisions that were responsible for Nineveh, Saladin, Kirkuk, Diyala, and then basically they faded, they're gone. And, I mean, you have some faint representations of them today, but their divisions in name, particularly in Diyala and Saladin and Anbar, they're a shadow of their former selves. The government has really been relying upon the militias and Shiite volunteers who are attached to them. And there are stories of Iraqi military helicopters taking militia fighters around to places for battles. I suppose the reconstruction, the U.S. military made a huge effort to train the Iraqi military from 2004 through 2011, and the problems that resulted in the collapse of the Iraqi military were, the emphasis upon political patronage over competency, a culture eruption of positions being for sale. Oftentimes, divisions would have half the number they were supposed to because soldiers would be on the roster but they didn't report. They were paid. They got to keep half their salary, and the rest went up from, you know, lieutenant to captain to colonel to division commander. So for the Iraqi military to work, one, it needs to be an inclusive institution representative of all Iraqis, but this culture of corruption has to be weeded out, and it can't be a politicized institution. But these problems were there while the Americans were in Iraq, and the Americans weren't able to root it out. It's for the Iraqis to do. So maybe that'll happen now. And one idea that's talked about, which maybe will work, and it deals with the militia issue, is the idea that of National Guards. Now, this is an idea that these themselves have been floating. It's being called National Guards now. Secretary of State Kerry referred to it today during his visit, but over the months talking with Sunnis from places like Anbar, for instance, who've been involved in the fight against the Iraqi government, one of their core demands was that the military should be out of the cities and out of the provinces, and that a local force, a local police, should be running the security in these areas. And Haider Abadi, I believe, buys into that idea to an extent. He said so in his speech on Monday night when he was sworn in. And he was also talking about this as a way to integrate the militias that are now fighting into a state apparatus. I mean, in fact, the militias are technically under the chain of the command of the Iraqi government, and they have been since April or even March. They were authorized by Prime Minister Maliki to fight in Anbar and the Baghdad, because he saw them as more effective than a military that was weak because of corruption and the lack of soldiers, the ghost soldier problem, et cetera. So I guess the idea is to kind of have the army itself for protecting the borders, and the provinces should be administering their own revenues from the oil revenues of the national government, and they should be also securing their local borders of the province with their own police and National Guard. So that might be, you need this complete restructuring of the military to eradicate these problems that have been with the military since the time of the Americans and only got worse after, but that no one was able to solve. And then this new idea of decentralization and giving the powers of security, administration, financial spending to the provinces. And that's something that's popular with Shia, it's popular with Kurds, not all Shia, and it's popular with Sunnis, not all Sunnis. Some Sunnis want a strong national government. The question with the National Guard issue is, does it really work, or does it essentially become a warlord force for different powers within provinces?
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Ray Gerard with American Friends Service Committee.
Well, thank you so much for organizing this discussion. My question is regarding the other major players in Iraq. While the mainstream narrative now is that the U.S. is stepping in to combat this one bad guy and ally with, you know, our friends, it seems that there is enough evidence that other players, including the Iraqi central government and Shiite militias and other ethnic militias, have been committing human rights abuses and atrocities. Yesterday, Reuters had a good piece entitled Iraq Shiites and Kurds Use U.S. Airstrikes to Further Their Own Agendas. And in the piece, there is a good discussion about Iraq's flag was the least visible in the fighting, that militias were fighting under their own banners, and that some of the militias were referring to the Shiite militias as the Shiite ISIS. So I would like you to elaborate a little bit about that, especially with the current plans to arm and train some of these groups who have been accused of gross violations of human rights.
Sure. Some feedback, huh? The points you raised are good ones, and I thought that article by my colleague Isabel Coles was very important because it showed, I think, the sensitivity of
of really having a game plan for, you know, fighting the Islamic State that goes beyond just military action, or having a quote-unquote inclusive government about the need to be able to create programs on the ground that give everybody faith that the system is going to work and protect them and do what functioning democratic governments do. If there are just airstrikes and no real government plan for reform, it allows openings for different armed factions on the ground to work for their own agendas and what they see as a, you know, a sectarian conflict. You know, I what I've found interesting in the last year, because everything that's, you know, inside Iraq, not talking about Syria at all now, but the rise of the Islamic State, the ability to take Mosul, and the rise of the militia groups that you're referring to with their flags, this has all been cumulative over, I would say, a two-year process, with where for every attack by the Islamic State that you would have, let's say a suicide bombing, the wounded people, would have a ripple effect, you know, throughout the neighborhood. So everyone had a real sense of loss and grievance, and then and the demand for justice. And because the state couldn't provide justice, these Shiite militia groups became more powerful. You know, the Islamic State enables the radical militant Shiite groups, and the radical militant Shiite groups enable the Islamic State. So without a true plan for good governance and political reconciliation, you know, these things that I keep talking about, like, you know, accountable security forces, public officials accountable for their budgets. I mean, Iraq's budget, every year there are lump sums outlined that's passed by the parliament, but there's no year-end accounting for where the money's been spent since 2004. I mean, these things have to happen along with a military campaign, because otherwise you end up with what you did in northern Iraq, what my colleague witnessed, which is airstrikes to liberate, you know, Shiite Turkmen who are under siege and shouldn't die and should be saved, but in helping and contributing with airstrikes that then allow hardline Shiite militia groups to go on a rampage and burn homes of Sunnis who had fled and will no longer be able to come back. So, I mean, America has to be very careful ground in what its actions are. In fighting the Islamic State, does it want to be contributing to a sectarian cleansing? That's a real danger. Anyway, I'm not sure if I answered your question completely, but we can go
on. We have so many questions in queue, and I'm sorry that we will be unable to get to all of them. It's clear that we probably need to have another conference call on this subject with you. We'll just take one more, and I ask that you be brief to the next question, or whoever it is.
Our last question comes from Richard Dreyfuss with Dreyfuss Initiative.
Thank you. It seems to me that all the solutions that you've talked about, or the lack of solutions that we've talked about, all are hinged on our partners in this endeavor being incorruptible, or getting to a point where they can be incorruptible, and it doesn't seem like that seems likely. Are you not mentioning the fact or the opinion that this seems to be an unsolvable problem, that these people are not going to give up what they have to give up in time, or are we just spinning our wheels here? It just seems so depressingly futile that we can get an honest accounting from our partners in this area. Are you staying away from saying that, or is it possible to actually illustrate what a solution might be? Thanks.
Sure. I'm not sure what the solution is, but what I would say, I've painted like a bleak picture, and that's because the situation is quite dire. the government has a challenge to assert its authority and a challenge to assert its authority in a way in which it's accountable and responsible to the people, and it needs to reassert control of areas. I mean, it has to reassert control of Sunni territory and of Shiite militias, and it's complicated. But what I would say is that most Iraqis, or the positives are that most Iraqis have a strong sense of nationalism, of being Iraqi. In times like these, as things become more extreme, they drift more towards sectarian identity. But I would say offside, ordinary people want to live prosperous lives, and because they do, it doesn't make it less horrible, the loss they've suffered in bloodshed, but they're aware of the rest of the world, and they see how others live, and they want that. And the demands of the younger generation are so huge, and the expectation that they should have a good life, because Iraq is an incredibly wealthy country, is a pressure on the political class. And at some point, if the political class cannot get its act together, they risk losing everything as well. It's a gamble for them. And I would say, I think there are Iraqi politicians, including Abadi, who are aware of what's at stake and are trying to look at the problems in methodical ways, in fresh ways, and they're aware of the failures of the state. The question is, have things reached such a point now it's too late for them to do anything, or are they too weak to be able to, you know, convince others to follow them? And we shall see.
Well, Ned, thank you very much for today's call, and to all of you for your insight, for your questions. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Arena, for having me, and thanks everyone for listening to me for the last hour. So have a good Wednesday.
Yes, and again, just to remind people to follow Ned on Twitter at EdMParker1, and we look forward to continuing to follow your reports, Ned, and your tweets from Baghdad. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.